At this time, the chairperson should briefly qualify. Requirements for chairing a meeting at Central Orlando Group Saturday Night Speakers Meeting are 1 year of continuous sobriety, have Central as your home group, and attend a group conscience meeting. My name is Tim, and I am definitely an alcoholic. I have met all those requirements. I followed the Tim plan for 34 years of my life, and through a series of bad decisions, I made a mess out of all the things God had given me to be a good steward of. And I came into Alcoholics Anonymous when I had no other options. And I begrudgingly followed some suggestions, and I can honestly tell you that that I did nothing to get to the place that I am today, that I am only sober through the grace of loving and caring and understanding God. All I did was show up. And so if you're new or you're coming back, please don't think you have to do a whole lot other than walk in the door and let God change you. Anyway, that's my story. I'm sticking to it. Thank you.
Thanks.
Okay. Everything okay in there, Gene? Okay, good. Let me make sure you're all right. let's see. The reminder. I'm supposed to remind you that the group has asked me to remind you to please make sure your phones are off and to refrain from moving around or talking while the speaker is sharing. And when I picked up this this opportunity and was looking through who better to start things off with a bang, I tried with all of my might to come up with somebody else, but God has put this guy in my heart. And when I was still drinking, I would drive down the road and I would see this guy. I didn't know who he was at the time, but the things that he would hold up a sign and one of them said, "Be encouraged." And so this saint has been instrumental in my recovery in the past year and a half, and he is proof in my life that God was healing me before I knew his name. So without further ado, ladies and gentlemen, put your hands together for Mr. Jerry D.
Take off my yarmulke. Come here, you big guy.
Yes, love you.
All right. Well, that's about my story. We have a nice big closing. Oh, my. It's good to be with my friend.
My name is Jerry, and I'm an alcoholic.
Jerry.
My sobriety date's April 23rd, 1975. I never say that in a bragging way, because it's people like you, my higher power, and a few other things that kept me sober all these years. I have a note to myself, because I was taught early on that when you give a talk in AA, it should have three basic ingredients. The first one, what it was like. Second is what happened and what it's like now. And I'm going to put this here to remind me. Hopefully I won't go over. And just as a P.S., that sign that he saw that said, basically, don't everybody run out of the room, but I am a minister, but very unorthodox, okay? Very unorthodox. I have a church with no walls. It's called the Church of the Open Road. It's for people who don't want to go to church. People say, well, where's your church? I said, right where we're standing, you want to have church in. If my bishop heard me saying that, but he does know that I'm a weirdo. I'm the only guy that has a license to preach in a black holiness Pentecostal church that still goes to mass three times a week. That bishop doesn't know it. The other one knows about it. But. Where was I? Oh, yes.
What it was like.
What it was like. Anyway, my sign says, be encouraged, right?
That's right.
And he saw it, and the rest of it, this is why he's here tonight. Well, I was born on April the 1st, 1935, which, of course, at that point, I should have known something was up April Fool's Day, you know. I've lived that down all my life. And a family member that broke my heart was an alcoholic. And the last time I used the name, and I felt kind of bad about it, because the guy was very close to me. And I never wanted to be like him, but I loved him dearly, drunk or sober, and I was his champion. And I'll get to that in a minute, but he did go, as far as I know, a blessed memory, he did die sober in AA at about 60 years old. A little emotional there, I'm sorry. Things went along pretty good for me until about the age of 10. And I already haven't had a drink. I think I was born a drunk, but they didn't have Infants Anonymous at the time. Yeah, this sounds strange, like everything else I have to say tonight will be strange. I found a drumstick with a black mark on it. That should have been an omen to me. I found it in a gutter, and I picked up that drumstick, and I started banging on things, you know, and banging on teapots and hitting boards and baggages and cardboard boxes and anything. And I found out that I really loved banging on things. People, too, when I was drunk. But anyway, I started playing drums, and I got pretty good at it, and I played in a high school band and all that kind of stuff. And then I saw too many John Wayne movies, too many Sands of Iwo Jima, and a Korean War came by, and I said, I think that's what I ought to do because I don't like school anyway. And I kind of had in the back of my mind hope that I could get in a Marine band, which would have been a real feather in my cap if I could have, but I didn't have. So I went to boot camp. And if anybody was not a candidate for the United States Marine Corps, this drugstore cowboy, your dad would know what I was talking about. They used to call us drugstore cowboys. Those are people that have never been out of the local drugstore, never been anywhere, don't know zip from zap, and go and face the United States Marine Corps boot camp, and a bunch of guys who know, Lord only knows where they came from, and they didn't know where I came. We didn't know anybody. They shaved our heads and gave us the uniform and said, lots of luck, guys, you know. So I did get through boot camp, miraculously, and a bunch of the older guys and myself one night took a Jeep down into the beautiful little town of Tijuana, Mexico. If anybody's been to Tijuana, Mexico, and you hit the border there, if you don't have a gun when you go in, they give you one, you know. It's a pretty rough place. And so we're down there, and there's a place called Harry's Long Bar. Anybody been to Tijuana? Whoa, look at the hands go up. I don't know if it's still down there or not. But the trick was that it was a very long bar. I'm not going to say it was a mile long, but it was long, probably from here over to the street. And the trick was to see if you could drink from one end of the bar to the other end of the bar and see how long it would take. Well, it didn't take us long enough to get too far, you know. And we got back in the car, or the Jeep, and on our way up, it was Highway 395, I believe, right off 101. We had an accident, and a cab driver hit us and knocked me in the back. I was drunk in the back of the seat, and the driver was driving and knocked us in a 20-foot gully. And when I came to, my neck was like this. And Pete, God bless him, wherever Pete is, Pete was a wrestler and a rough guy. And he, about this guy's size here, about Tim's size, he says, what's the matter with you? I says, well, look at me, my neck. What do you know? Give me that neck. I can take care of that. I didn't know I had a broken neck. Folks, I had a broken neck in two places. You think God doesn't exist? He's got a hole in my head. So the guy decides, the guy driving the car said, this is too much for me, I'm getting out of here. And I said, you better take me somewhere. So he took me to Camp Pendleton, the Navy hospital. And the doctor took one look at me, he says, like this, he says, get on the gurney. I said, yes, sir. He says, you got a broken neck, young man, in two places. I was in the hospital 5 months, and by miraculous, absolute miracle, I came out of there alive. The only thing is, I won't go through the gruesome things that they put me through to get my neck back in shape, but one of the things that was rough is they put me in a body cast, and they had holes here, a hole for my belly button, and a little bit of hole here, and it was all the way down almost to my knees and my neck, and they propped my neck up like this. And I was like that for 3 months. So it came time to get the neck, the body cast off, and they took it off, and I swear to you, my neck was still crooked. And I went to this master surgeon and said, what's the matter? I said, you look at my neck. He says, what's the matter? I said, you put my head on wrong. So he must have reported, you know, they have these staff meetings and they, what do you think of Davis? I think he's nuts is what I think he is. You know. The best thing for him is a little bit of recreational. We're going to send him to Korea. They sent me to Korea. And but the thing I found out later, I wasn't supposed to go to Korea because I was only 17. I was supposed to, you know, that doesn't work over there. But guys, don't shoot. I'm only 17. It doesn't work. You know? So I got through that. No John Wayne heroics. I won't even go into that because not much to tell. And they sent me back to the States. And, of course, I was a ripe 19 and almost 20-year-old kid that didn't know zip from zap, still didn't know anything, didn't know what to do. Well, I figured, well, I could always play drums. So I got a job, playing, getting back in the swing of things, so to speak. And I got a job, and it was the youngest member of the union, and they gave me a job in a strip joint playing drums. And you better not be drunk playing drums in a strip joint, because the dancers at times do certain movements, and the tom-tom better hit in sync with her movements. And if you're drunk, then it doesn't work. I mean, she throws it out there, and 2 minutes later, and everybody's going, what is that? You know, does the bomb go off? Thank you for some of you trying to figure it out. You could just talk amongst yourself. If you're trying to figure out what to say, just go ahead. I mean, I don't want to say the place was rough, but on New Year's Eve, they found a guy in the back murdered, and he was dead in the John. It was a pretty rough place. And so anyway, a buddy of mine gave me a job, and he says, you know, I had no credits hardly at all in high school. I didn't have a GED, and there was a fine Jesuit college in Cincinnati called Xavier University. And me getting into college with no high school, I had 1.5 credits in band, and I think 1 credit in English, I think. That's what I had for 4 years. I'd gone 2 or 3 different grades. You know, it's, I didn't skip. I went back. Hey, so anyway, he gave me a job, and he says, what do you want to do with your life? I said, heck, I don't know what to do. And he says, well, look, he said, let me talk to Father Bevavit, and we'll see if we can get you in on probation. Lo and behold, they put me in the university, and for the first two semesters, I did really well. Now, one of the reasons I did really well was I didn't know what the word plagiarism meant. I really honestly...
Amen, brother, preach it.
I thought it was some sort of religion. You know? So I'm even entertaining myself. Can I say that? So they had the national contest, the Jesuit contest, for the best essay on the primacy of Peter. And now, of course, you know who he was. And so I go to the library and I look up all the books that I can find on Peter. And I write this most eloquent piece you ever saw in your life. 4, 5, 6 pages, copied right out of the best books on Peter that you could find. How that Jesuit that was judging those things, I don't know. He didn't realize it. He said, that is probably... And oh, and I forgot to tell you, I was a convert on top of that because I didn't know what else to do with my life, so I decided to become a Catholic. You know? So I did. And he said, that was really fantastic. Oh, I got all kinds of... They never did figure out that I had plagiarized the whole thing. And honestly, I didn't know what plagiarism meant. I really didn't. I was some kind of gum disease or something. So that didn't work out too well. I guess I spent about 3.5 years in college, off and on, night school, day school, and all that. I did play in the college band. You know, I did get into the band. And in the meantime, I kept on playing in little groups and things like that. And then I got this idea that I would like to become a monk. I don't know. I got that from reading Thomas Merton's Seven Story Mountain. You're reading Merton now, and I know you know about Merton. Some other people know about Merton. I see some heads shaking. So I went to Father, whatever his name was, Dietz or somebody, and I said, you know, I've been thinking about this. And he says, that what? I said, I want to go to Gethsemane down at Bardstown, Kentucky, to the Trappist Monastery to be... He just looked his head and said, you are not Trappist Monastery material. And I said, why? He says, you're a zealot. Because they heard what I do. When I became Catholic, it's almost like when you get to be sober. You know, you just start, or you quit smoking. Worse, when you quit smoking, you tell, you realize that's going to kill you? Oh, God, please, don't leave me alone. You know, so now I'm a Catholic, and I'm in with guys that have been through 12 years of parochial school, and I'm telling them what they should do. It's time for them to go out on their little jaunt on the weekend, and I'm in the dorm, and I'm telling them that they're late coming in. I'm telling them, you know, you go up to that crucifix and you tell them what you're going to do. And I won't elaborate, but you can read between the lines. I said, go ahead and tell them what you just told me you're going to do. I'm going to go out and I'm going to... See, stop. I said, you shouldn't talk like that. Well, they got word of it back at headquarters. This Jesuit knew that I was a nutcase, and they weren't going to send me. He says, because they need people down there that are grounded. And, Jerry, you're not grounded. I said, no, I thought I was grounded, but you're not grounded. Mm. So being a new Catholic, I did the best thing most Catholics at that time, prior to Vatican II. Voice, don't go on me now. what did I do? Oh, yes, I got married. Because that was in the new catechism. If you can't be a priest, be another person that has lots of kids. Doesn't make any difference if you can afford them or not, you know. So we had six kids in 5 years, and it was all legal. It was legal. It wasn't anything. And how that happened was somehow or other, well, you women know about the thing and the bop, the deep, the cycles and all that thing. I thought it was something you wrote. I didn't know. It's a cycle. And so the cycle with her just worked. And then the Jewish doctor took over for my regular doctor. Are you enjoying yourself? He took over my regular doctor. And he said, you ought to be ashamed. You haven't even paid for the first six. What are you doing? Having another kid? Come on, you know. He really made me feel bad. But not for long. But anyway, we had all these kids, so I had to do something. So I got a job. And a band came along that wanted somebody to play drums for them, and it was a real good band. I don't know if anybody ever heard of the Mickey Finn Band out in California. No hands, one head shake. Mickey Finn Band is a sit-in band, so we have two or three instruments, or four regulars, and then we invite all the people from the Broadway shows that are playing in town and any instruments that are playing, and they come in and jam with us. So I was having a ball. We all had tuxedos. I had a great job. I was in a good lounge, and I was drinking very heavily. And then I found out that if you're in the band, you could have your own room. Big mistake. I had my own room in the hotel, playing it all, you know. And even though at the age 76 years old, semi-bald, a little bit toothless, I was not that way when I was playing drums. So, believe it or not, this old man, I almost said a bad word, all this old man had a groupie. And that groupie drove me crazy. And as a result of her driving me crazy, things happened, and I left home, and I left the family, which I'm not proud of at all. And she and I eventually got married. We had a child. And that lasted a while. I won't go into how many times I've been married. I'm not proud of that, but I've got letters from three different states that please do not apply for a marriage license. My voice is going. Maybe some of you are welcome. Glad I'm. So, there was a big land boom in Atlanta, and by that time I had just about shot everything I could do, and I got lucky for about a year. A guy came into my car lot I was working on, and he wanted to buy a car for one of his salesmen. And he was a real sharp guy. He had a diamond pinky and a sharp, real dress, you know. And I said, what's your name? He says, Hilton. I said, Hilton. I went to the boss. I said, I've got Mr. Hilton out here. Boy, wait a minute. Well, it wasn't the Mr. Hilton. And I said, what do you do for a living? Well, he says, young man, he says, I save corporations money. He says, lots of money, and I put a lot of it in my pocket, and it's legal. I said, good. I'll go to work for you for $500 a week. He just looked at me and laughed. He says, send me your resume. Okay, I hardly even knew what that was. He handed me a card. I said, dear Mr. Hilton, I have no idea what you do, but if it works out mutually beneficial for both of us, I'd be glad to talk to you, period. Jerry Davis is my phone number. The secretary called me and said, he has never had a resume like that in his life. He wants to talk to you. Little did I know, this guy was a nutcase because he wanted me to be him. Literally, he says, you don't know enough yet to be you. But I've been me for all these, Cesso and Robert Hall. But anyway, he says, you call people, the top people in the country on Dun & Bradstreet's top 400 or 500 companies, and tell them you're Henry Hilton, you want an appointment, you got something you want to tell them. So he trained me with an 18-page presentation. He made me tape every call. He got me, when I would say get, he'd say, you said get, it's get. And he says, you've got to talk. He's called it pillow talk. I said, pillow talk? He said, when you're talking to these guys, you've got to talk pillow talk to these people. You know, you lower your voice. You've got to enunciate, articulate. You've got to be sharp. I'm going to make you one of the sharpest guys you ever saw. And he did. He says, and if you do exactly what I say, he says, you will make a lot of money. And I made a lot of money quickly, which is the worst thing a drunk can do for me. First thing I did, my stepdaughter wanted a horse. Now, I'd never been on a horse. We found a place that sold horses. Ironically, it's a place that sold. So here's a horse over there. And she says, oh, I love that horse. I said, okay. So I said to the owner, I said, what's that horse in the corner? He said, oh, that's Dinah. I said, Dinah? He says, yeah. I said, well, what's the matter? He said, well, Dinah had a problem with gas. And this was a Western horse fighting place. So they went out on trails. So you know where they made Dinah and I? The end of the trail. Because nobody wanted us in front of the trail for obvious reasons. So we would get drunk and go up to the drive-in theaters and ride our horses up there and watch everybody, you know, watch the movie for nothing and ride on. And that crazy scene went on for about 6 months. Spent a lot of money. My kids came up. I mean, it was unbelievable. I finally got a chance to see my kids, and I outfitted them. Now, they're in Cincinnati, Ohio, where I was born there. I send them back to Cincinnati to their mother with cowboy hats, cowboy boots, chaps, fancy shirts, buckles, all kinds of things, whatever, boleros and everything. She said, I need the money. And then when the kids, I found out later, and these kids were all making fun of them, because they never saw anything like this. Kids come to school dressed like cowboys and cowgirls. But I thought I was doing the right thing. Well, the boss, I was doing very well. Had three big major projects, made a lot of money very quickly. And the boss in Connecticut, Richfield, Connecticut, says, you better get to work. He says, this money's going to run out. You don't have any new projects. Yeah. And, of course, I'm drinking like crazy. By that time, IRS is on my neck. Everybody in town's on my neck. And they're starting to repossess cars that went to Take Back Man. Where's Bob? Remember when I did Take Back Man the other night? In Georgia, they say the Take Back Man done snap my sheen. So I made up a song, Take Back Man done snap my sheen, doo-dah. And I was having a ball with it, but I was losing my car, Jack. My car was gone. Oh, my. And so I left one car with my sweet wife, Cindy. May she rest in peace, and I mean that sincerely. And I took off for Atlanta for the land boom. And land booms, you buy raw land, syndicate it, sell it to people that didn't know what they were doing. And I didn't know what I was doing, except they gave me this thing and a kit and said, go sell something. So we went and sold something, and 50 cent stock was horrible. And I doubt to this day if it was legitimate, but I didn't know any more than I knew what plagiarism was. So I did that, and things really got bad, really, really bad. And I was drinking very, very, very heavy. And my wife is still up in town, up in Hudson, Ohio. Hudson, Ohio, they call it a little sleepy town with Dutch Elms disease, whatever that meant, you know. Peyton Place with Dutch Elms disease, that's what it was. One of those bedroom-type communities. And I say that literally. It's a wild place, but very upscale. So she was stuck there as the IRS padlocked the house. The sheriff was after me and her. They had warrants out for us because we hadn't paid any bills. Our neighbors, God bless them, they had to take my wife. I'm not proud of this, folks. This is not meant to be funny at all. They put my wife and my kids and our St. Bernard dog in the back seat and covered them over and escorted them out of town to get out away from the sheriff and came down to Hotlanta, Georgia. In the meantime, I'm drunk as I can be, doing everything crazy, and we stayed at Holiday Inn or someplace. Sandy got a job as a desk clerk, and my little kid was doing casual labor, picking up stuff. I don't know what the heck I was. I was drinking pretty heavily. And one night, I was really, really swacked, and I passed out in a bar. The name of the bar was Bruiser's Pub. Now, there's a bar for you, you know. And the guy had been the Green Bay Packers, and he owned the bar. One night, I'm passed out in the walkthrough where the girls pass the drinks through and the food through, and I'm passed out there, and the owner is twice the size as him and you. This guy's a big, humongous guy. I said, who's that? And she says, well, that's Mr. Davis. He was as drunk as I was. I had a nice suit on, you know, and I still looked halfway presentable except for some smudges here and there. And he said, we can't have that in here. Does he come in here often? She says, yes, he does, but her name was Linda. He said, well, you tell him he better stay in here and drink here because he can't go around from bar to bar like that. He says, so the place closed. The next thing I know, vaguely, this guy picks me up literally. He throws me over his shoulder, takes me down to the Tudor Inn down on 275 in Sandy Springs, Georgia. goes, typical Good Samaritan thing, goes to the guy at the desk and says, give this guy a room. When he wakes up, if there's anything he needs, put it on my tab, just like the Good Samaritan. So the next morning I woke up in a pretty bad fog and was still pretty tired, and there was a field in back of this place, and there was a field in back of Bruiser's Pub. So I lay down in the field and take some more naps, some more sleep. What else? You know, I'm tired. I got to go to sleep somewhere. So a security guard comes over and says, what are you doing? I said, what am I doing? You know, I'm taking a nap. He said, you can't stay here. You're bothering the tenants. I said, I work for Growth Land Systems. Really? He says, Growth Land Systems haven't been in business in 6 months. I said, well, no wonder I haven't had a paycheck in a while. So I crawled back up, literally, up to the bar, and Linda was on duty. It was about, I remember vaguely, it was about 25 to 11. And I said, Linda, I've had it. I don't know what to do. Please call me a cab. I got a little room out on the Marietta Highway. They don't say Marietta and George, Marietta Highway. So I got out there, and I got in a cab, and I got in the back seat of the cab, and as best memory serves, I put my hands on my head, and I cried out. I said, dear God, I need help. I've got to call AA. And I knew about AA because my dad had been in. No offense to anybody that may be from South Georgia, but they'd have a different way of talking. And the guy leaned over in the back seat and says, hi, my name is Lemar, and I ain't been to one of them meetings in 6 months, but these two guys will help you. And he handed me a card with two guys' phone numbers on it and an AA clubhouse. Hey, ain't been to meet in 6 months. What do you think of that? I call them. They said, can you stay off booze till noon till we can get you to a meeting? I said, yeah. Where are you again? I said, I'm at the Thunderbird Hotel on Marietta Highway. So, okay, we'll be there. So they came and took me to a meeting. And I tell you, I didn't know zip from zap, but I'll never forget. Every group, maybe even this group, has a Maggie. Now, Maggie's in around 67, 68 years old. Been around since the Lord left Chicago on a bicycle. She's doing the chips, and the first chip she says under every dress is a slip. What? She's talking about 13 steps. Now, don't everybody act like you know what I'm talking about. That was her way of presenting chips. Under every dress is a slip. That's all I remember the first thing. Second thing, they said, can you stay off liquor till 6 o'clock tonight? We can get you a meeting in your own area where you can get somebody. Introduced me to a guy, Bob, who immediately he and I almost had a fist fight in the clubhouse because I was still a punk. So he gave me to Pat, and Pat took good care of me. Pat, God bless him, but he didn't put up with any of my shenanigans. The first thing they told me, what happened? Come on, what happened? The first thing they told me was the concept of one day at a time, one drink at a time. Now stay away from one drink, one day at a time. And get to these meetings. The second thing they said of great importance was be sure that you join a group and get active in a group. They didn't care if you had 10 minutes or 2 weeks. You went on 12-step calls with somebody that had at least 2 years. The guys that 12-step me, the one guy had 2 weeks, the other guy had about two and a half years. And I can identify more with the guy that had 2 weeks than I could identify with the guy that 2.5 years. How do you stay off booze for two weeks? Well, you know. So I got to take a break, folks. My voice is going. They said, "Hey, Flaky," that was my name. "Hey, Flaky, what? What are you doing Saturday?" I said, "Well, no, that's the first thing you don't do, you don't think. You come down to the clubhouse and rearrange the pictures." I said, "Rearrange the pictures?" He said, "That'll be a starter. We'll find something for you to do. Don't worry about it. And tonight, you will stand at the door like we try to get people to here. Most of you do it. Very nice. Shake hands. Get to know people, you know." Or is that loud enough? Okay. And he says, "We have a phone there. Do you see a phone in the corner?" I said, "Yes, that's the relay phone." He said, "What the heck's a relay? We have races after the meeting." He says, "No." He says, "We're on relay and no call. It's going on a 12-step call." Oh, okay. And, as you know, in those days, we made our own coffee, right? You will make the coffee. And in those days, we had smoking rooms, okay? And you will clean the ashtrays, and you know the rest of it. And tomorrow morning is Sunday, and we have an eating meeting. We have bacon and eggs and ham and everything. You will be here and work on that. I said, "Good grief." You know what I'm saying? Did they ever leave me alone? Well, that was a trick. They didn't leave me alone. And when I finally get out of there at 11:30, two or three of them would come by. on my motel room. I, what do you want? I just want to make sure you're okay. I'm fine. Will you let me sleep? Another thing I loved and appreciated, they would come down where you were working, but they wouldn't embarrass you or anything. They'd go stand outside and go, like that. The boss had said, who are those? I said, don't worry about it. They're some of my friends. They'll be all right. You know, they'll move along in a minute. So I was brought up very, very hardcore AA. What you, some of you would call probably tough love. They did not put up with any of my shenanigans at all. And when I was wrong, they did not hesitate to tell me. And I needed that kind of love. And today, I don't know if we have a tendency to kind of go easy on some newcomers and everything, but they didn't have much tolerance for, you know, this program is a program of recovery and it's a program of action. And you will stay active in this program. You will go to meetings every day. And one day I went in a meeting and they took me to a new meeting and somebody's talking and the subject came up and I said, I felt like I don't want like it. And I got this, bam, under the table. Kick, shut up, you don't know anything. And somebody, I've been in meetings, anybody talk to me like that, I'd get up and leave, by golly. Well, fine, you get up and leave then, because that's the way they taught me to do it. So I got very active, and I did, they actually had me speak in 90 days, which was a real chance. You know, I got to tell you, P.S., this is me, but a buddy of mine in Fort Lauderdale was sponsored by Clancy. Y'all know who Clancy is? Heard of Clancy? Okay, the infamous Clancy. He said, for 90 days, you will listen to Clancy tapes. So he made him listen to Clancy tapes for 90 days. He says, at the end of 90 days, you're going to speak. Oh, okay. So he gets up to speak. Whose talk do you think he gave? He gave Clancy's talk. I found out a year later, Clancy found out about it. He didn't like it too much. He was very upset about it. But can you imagine giving somebody else's talk? I'm still on what happened. Okay. It's kind of like what it's like now and a crossover between what happened and what it's like now. What happened was my own personal life kind of got better. A big mistake, I got back with my ex-wife. It wasn't her fault. It was just she was still drinking, but not in an excessive way. But it did make me nervous. And, of course, I lied. This doesn't bother you, does it? Oh, no. Go ahead. Have a drink. No, it did bother me. And she'd been a stewardess, and she had little stew bottles, and they stuck behind the cabinet where you couldn't see him, and that kind of stuff. And it was making me nervous. So I left and did that kind of stuff. And I know I'm rushing real quick now because I don't want to take up too much time. It's almost 8:45. What I did then is I fell back into the band business, and I got real active in that. And that's I'm kind of like I said, in between the two subjects. So I'll try to stay with what happened. I just stayed close to AA. I stayed close to my people. They also taught me about phone numbers. We pass around a sheet. I don't know how many people actually get calls from these calls that we pass around, but they said, you get your own private phone number. If you get uptight, you can't get to a meeting, you call. And I remember once I was in Atlanta, Georgia, and I couldn't get to a meeting. I had a five-hour layover, and the bar looked real good. And I called a guy at Intergroup in Atlanta. And he said, where are you from? I said, Orlando. That's all. He knew Joe Harkowitz, who I can use his last name, who died. He set up Central Group and all. And I mean, we had about 15, 20 minutes conversation. So I did what I was told to do. So there was no excuse for me to say, well, I couldn't get to a meeting. You know, I got phone numbers. I got people I can call. I can contact people. Or I can go up to somebody that looks like they've had one too many and say, are you feeling all right, Sonny? No. You can go up to him and say, try to take it. You're not feeling well? Well, we have a solution. Well, one other thing I got to tell you quickly. What happened? At the meetings that we had in Georgia, we did not have, now don't everybody go, oh my God, what a big mistake. We did not have a lot of emphasis on the big book. And not a lot of emphasis on the steps. The emphasis was on working with wet alcoholics. Really, seriously. I've been in meetings when guys have pulled out bottles and drank right in the meeting. Of course, they weren't allowed. We stopped it, but that's the kind of stuff that we see. Seldom have I been in. I go to a lot of meetings here, usually 5 to 6 a week. I've not seen anybody walk in. I've seen people come in drunk, but I've never seen anybody pull a bottle out. But that's the kind of stuff that we had to deal with. And we have one expert. We didn't have a bunch of experts on the big book. But we had one expert. His name was Vance. He was a big old fat country boy. And if any question came up in the meeting about what's in the big book, he'd say, "Vance, is that right?" And that would be the end of that. We would sometimes wonder about Vance. So that's what we did. Well, later on, it came pretty obvious to me, I better get with these steps. And I did. About 3 months later, I got a guy and I took my fourth and fifth step and I did all the things the book said. And then I started getting in this idea that I don't have to take another fourth or fifth. I already took it once. I really bought into that. No, I have to do that. And I throw a lot of it into the tenth step. And if I have to take another third or fourth or fifth, I get to my sponsor and tell him some of the bad things that come. By the way, that's something that happens to you if you're long-term sober. Your mind starts working on things that happened, and you start remembering things. The fog starts lifting. You say, "Oh my God, did I do that? You know, and do I need to call them?" And that's when you got to be very careful. You know what it says? Except when to injure them would kill them or others. No. See, I knew my. I told you I didn't have a background. And why am I talking to you? I don't even like it. All right, enough of that. I got to go on what it's like now. Folks, I'd like to tell you it's been a cakewalk. It's been the most fantastic experience I ever had in my life. It has to a certain extent, but I've had more problems and more troubles sober than I ever had drunk. And the reason I can say that is because drunk, when the problems came over, I would anesthetize them. Father Martin says, you help me with this. He says that the chemical formula for alcohol is the same thing as ether with the water removed. So we are anesthetized when we're walking around with drinks in our. And they say one or two drinks will do it. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's not good to have 18 or 20 of them, but some of us have had that or more. But that you're anesthetized. You're not even thinking straight.
Right.
And so, now that I'm not thinking straight, what was my next subject? Oh, what it's like now. I was developing something there. I don't remember what it was.
Life could be good, but now it's...
Oh, life could be good. Yes. Life can be good, folks. Sounds like a soapbox. Life can be good. What can I say? How the hell would it? I'm finished. I promised myself I wouldn't cuss. I said one bad word. But I have a way of handling it. Now I'm going to get a little serious, which hurts me to the core. There's how I handle it. Some people say, "Well, that's academic." No, it's not academic. That's our program right there. History lesson. Clarence Snyder. Some of you know Clarence Snyder, know of Clarence Snyder. He was in the big book. He was the brewmaster, home brewmaster. One day over here in the other room, I said, "Clarence, I need a ride to Winter Park." He says, "You're not smoking, are you?" I said, "No, I don't smoke." "Good." He says, "My sponsor, he just gave me a new Crown Victoria, and I don't want anybody in my car that smokes." I said, "Okay, well, outside of that, can I get a ride to..." He said, "Yeah, okay." So, by the way, I got to tell you this. I can't believe I'm going to tell you this. Clarence Snyder and I were body catchers for Benny Hinn. I remember him to this day, standing to my left. Benny would slam in the spirit, and Clarence and I would catch him. And hopefully the woman behind him won 300-pound opera singer. We never lost one that I know of. Yeah, Clarence and I. So I said, "Clarence, I'm going to all these meetings. I'm not getting anything out of them. I've been sober 8 or 10 years. You're going to too many meetings." I said, "What?" He says, "The meetings you've been going to aren't talking about the program." I said, "What do you mean?" He says, "They're talking fellowship. They're talking about the yoga classes they're taking, the self-help book they've been reading, the exercises of a new boyfriend, new girlfriend, or whatever the deal is going on." He said, "Not talking program." He says, "This is a program." He wasn't knocking fellowship. Now, I'm not going to get onto that, because this is what we're doing now. We're having fellowship. You're helping me stay sober just as much as hopefully I'm helping you. Because that was what my prayer was tonight. Lord, let me get to somebody that might help him. Because I thought when I came in here, all week, I said, what can I possibly tell anybody that would help him? I couldn't think of anything other than don't drink and go to meetings, and you hear that all the time. But what better? Oh, another thing I want to say, and I'm not preaching now, I'm just making an observation. Sometimes I have got to believe that meeting makers make it. Yes, I know I have to do the steps, but once in a while in a meeting I'll hear, "Well, there's more to this program than just going to meetings." You know that? Yeah, I know that. You have to work the steps. But isn't it amazing that you look around the room and see people with 10, 15, 20, 30, 40, and Westby with almost 50 years that still go to meetings? So that must work. Meetings must work, wouldn't it? There must be some truth in it. I'm glad I prompted you before that you're agreeing with me. I don't give advice. Hopefully I don't give opinions. I try to give what happened to me and where I'm coming from, spirit, strength, and hope. To anybody that's new to the program, let it all filter in. This is a progress thing. This is a progressive thing. This is not something you come in here and say, oh, I got it, and go back out. I don't mind chips. I think they're great. Those chips are not graduation diplomas, folks. Those chips are just time markers to remind you. My buddy Chuck S. down in Fort Lauderdale had his gold medallion. He had his gold medallion in his pocket, and he went to pay his bill. And the girl says, oh, that's nice. What did that cost? He said about $500,000. It's nice to have them. So, it's you know, chips are important. But the thing is, you know, none of us ever graduate. The other thing, which is kind of hard to take sometimes, I never say I'll never take a drink again. But I know today I won't. And the reason I won't is because I got on my knees mentally, because I have a little hard time getting older, getting on my knees, but mentally, and ask God, dear God, this is my prayer every day. Please help me not to take a drink of alcohol. And if I can help another alcoholic, or anyone else for that matter, and it be thy will, so be it. And I've been saying that, and saying that, and saying that every day. And so I know that I can bet all $3 I have in my pocket. Why did I bring that up? No donations. See my agent. I know if I do that, I'll bet you anything I got in my pocket I won't drink today. But I'm never going to backburner my sobriety. I'm never going to sear my alcoholism and say, oh, yeah, I know. Well, I've got other problems. Yeah, of course, I'm an alcoholic. But you don't understand. Well, we understand a heck of a lot more than you think we do, especially those that have been around a while. So I'd like to end it with one thing, and I said it to somebody tonight. I don't remember who it is. I said, one thing that I never hear in meetings that I used to hear a lot when I first came in, be good to yourself because you deserve it. Thank you.